Earlier today, the Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act.
Welcome to a special Supreme Court edition of It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Don Gagne, fresh from the campaign trail, filling in for Mr. Ken Rudin today.
And Ken will be back next week to share his thoughts on the most important Supreme Court decision in more than a decade, of course having to do with the health care law known as Obamacare. And ironically, in this week when health care was on everyone's mind, Ken Rudin had a bit of a health care issue and wasn't able to be with us. We're so glad you could come in from the campaign trail, Don, and talk a little bit about the politics of the biggest issue of the day.
They're talking about it out there in the campaign trail, not just the candidates, but wander into the crowd. Now, I've been mostly at Republican events with Governor Romney, but they have been readying themselves for the Supreme Court to do something other than what they did today.
Exactly.
Just like the Republicans in Congress. Speaker Boehner has been saying all along, whatever the Supreme Court doesn't repeal, we're going to take care of the rest of it. They have a little bigger job than they thought.
A lot bigger job than they thought, because to everyone's surprise, John Roberts, the Chief Justice, stepped in with a rather novel reading of the entire situation and, as a result, voted to uphold the constitutionality of the law with some restrictions on the way it handles Medicaid. But the essential question of whether or not the law was constitutional and whether or not the individual mandate could stand was both decided against the law and then in favor of the law. Really confusing kind of a decision. Chief Justice John Roberts said, no, the individual mandate does not work under the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, which was the way the Obama administration had argued it. And, of course, four conservative judges on the court, including Anthony Kennedy, sometime swing voter, all agreed with that point, said, no, Commerce Clause does not work with this individual mandate. But then Roberts sided with the four Democrats on the Supreme Court, all appointed by Democratic presidents, and said, we think that the law itself is not unconstitutional for that reason, because the individual mandate is a tax, and Congress clearly has the power to tax and to tax people to make them do something, and then as a result, it's constitutional. Big shocker, nobody expected that from John Roberts.
And if you go back to the debate in Congress when this bill was working its way through, the Obama administration, Democrats, made it a point of not calling this a tax, because if you put that word tax in any piece of legislation, it's dead. So, in effect, it's like it's a question of semantics, and the Chief Justice is saying, well, you didn't call it a tax, but it is a tax.
It quacks like a duck. It walks like a duck.
And one of the very first emails in response to the ruling this morning that I got was from the Republican National Committee. And it's all about how, yes, the Supreme Court has just told us that the Obama administration and the Democratic Congress, which passed this bill, has approved a huge tax.
And, of course, it's a tax they don't have to pay if all they do is go out and get health insurance. And, of course, it will probably be disputed in months ahead and years ahead as people refuse to pay it and the IRS tries to collect it. There are all kinds of other more complicated ways of looking at this in the future, including the very real possibility that Congress, either this year or perhaps next year, if there is a Republican majority in the Senate and the House, will attempt to repeal that tax. And without the tax, presumably, change the constitutionality of the overall law. But for the moment, at a moment when the Republican Party was expecting to be highly vindicated by the Supreme Court throwing out this signature achievement, supposedly, of the Obama administration, they have been frustrated by the court's refusal to do so.
On the eve of this ruling, I was with Governor Romney in Sterling, Virginia, in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., 30 miles away or so. And he said the night before would be a sleepless night in the White House. He may indeed have been correct. I suspect Sasha and Malia slept just fine. But if there are high fives being done today, the Obama administration, that's where they're being done, within the White House. Though they probably kept the cameras away as they do that.
I suspect they did. There was to be no spiking of the ball, obviously, on either side. There would have been a lot of solemnity, I suppose, at least in front of the cameras. But I think the Obama people are relieved that he hasn't had this, as we said, signature achievement invalidated. And then we begin all of the back and forthing, which we knew would come once people started saying, well, who does this help? in the November election. And is it possible that the Mitt Romney people are just as happy to have an relatively unpopular law, or a law that at least does not poll well? Some of the individual parts of it poll very well, but the image of the law in general has not been a positive one. Are the Romney people just as happy to have that to run against?
It put wind in the sails of the Obama campaign team, in that they no longer have to defend this law as constitutional. They can say the Supreme Court, Justice John Roberts, has upheld what we have done here. But it also puts wind, an angrier wind, I think, in the sails of the anti-Obamacare, in quotes, factions within the U.S., and Mitt Romney is playing to them. And if there was any question that he might have a hard time keeping them energized through November or into November, this gives them plenty to be energized about. Whether they're really excited about Mitt Romney or not, as he put it in his statement today:
if we want to get rid of Obamacare, we're going to have to replace President Obama. My mission is to make sure we do exactly that.
Now, of course, if we do have a President Romney in January, I imagine he will make every effort to repeal Obamacare. He will need the cooperation of the Congress, which, if Mitt Romney is the president, will very likely be a Republican Congress, at least in the House and perhaps in the Senate as well. Very, very strong chance of that. So he could theoretically move ahead towards doing this, although he might need to have 60 votes in the Senate in order to do it. And no one thinks that the Republicans will have that many votes in the Senate, maybe 52-3, 54 at the most. And so that could be a problem. On the other hand, it's also possible that the Republicans who are currently in the Congress will move to repeal the law this year, will try to do what they can to remove the tax and therefore make it constitutionally suspect under John Roberts' definition.
We still have the summer and fall to go in the campaign. And my question is, what does this do for him and his campaign? We've talked about how it kind of will be a renewed burst of energy for the anti-Obamacare forces, for the Tea Party and others, some of whom have been a little ambivalent about Mitt Romney. Talk to them at campaign events, and they are often pretty quick to tell you they like Rick Santorum first, or they like Newt Gingrich first. So what does this do for him and how he campaigns?
I think it could probably be a good thing for him, and it could probably push him closer to the Tea Party, which, as you say, has been more of an arm's length kind of a relationship. And you've followed the Tea Party really since its very earliest events in the spring of 2009. I think it's fair to say that taxation was at the heart of the Tea Party movement, and that quickly the movement moved on to focusing on the health care bill. Mm-hmm. Now the health care bill is being reimposed on them in a sense as a tax increase, or as a potential tax increase, bringing together, if you will, their first impulses as political activists: taxes and the health care bill. Is this, in a sense, a rejuvenation for a movement which, you know, over the last couple of years has had a lot of success in the 2010 election, but really wasn't able to take control of the party the way they might have liked to have done, and was perceived by some people as a bit passé?
I suspect it's a very significant boost. And let's look back. The T in Tea Party does stand for taxed enough already. But I think absent the healthcare debate, we probably don't have a Tea Party. I don't think that's too strong of a statement. So, again, they had big successes in the 2010 election. They've kind of seemed to be fading, both in terms of public opinion and in influence over the past year, year and a half or so. I think this gives them kind of a renewed sense of purpose. Now, they're not starting from nowhere, as they did back almost 4 years ago. So we'll see if they are suddenly viewed differently. But I do think it's a big shot in the arm for them.
And I think it's a shot in the arm for a lot of Republican candidates for the House and for the Senate. The Republicans did not appear to be in much trouble in terms of holding their majority in the House. But, you know, you can find all kinds of prognostications about where things are going in the Senate. And this should help at least a couple of their candidates, light a fire and get people a little bit more excited about the election in the fall. And I think that's one of the reasons why people had been saying whoever wins in the court will be the loser, in a sense, on the campaign trail in the fall. Although it's a little hard for me to see how it would have been a great thing for the White House to have this major piece of legislation invalidated by the court and thrown out and made the presidency look as though it had all been kind of a waste.
It would have put President Obama on the defensive for the rest of the campaign. his signature legislative achievement tossed out. Mitt Romney, in fact, in recent days has been saying, if they throw it out, and again, he was speaking as though he assumed that was what was going to happen, at least the mandate would be struck down. His line was, it will be proof that President Obama wasted his first 3.5 years
perfect
in office. Now, he doesn't come out today and say, turns out he didn't waste his first 3.5 years. But I guess here's my question. We have seen Mitt Romney kind of softening his rhetoric, coming back to the center. The way he's talked about immigration is one good example of it. Does this force him to kind of stay to the right and keep talking about this issue, where this issue has not been a centerpiece of his speeches? It comes up about 10 minutes in, so it's like he's checking off the box. But does he have to play to the right a little more than he would like to in August, September, and October? And does that have an effect on how, you know, those voters in the middle, however many there are?
It's a very interesting point that it restores something of the dynamic for Mitt Romney that he had to go through in the primaries, and which they have tried to etch a sketch away and forget about and move him more and position him more as a middle-of-the-road alternative to a radical left-wing president. Maybe they can still do that, but they are going to have to at least salute some of the ideas of the Tea Party and, of course, the rabid anti-Obamacare elements of the Republican Party. You mentioned immigration a moment ago, and that brings to mind the decision that otherwise highlighted the last week of the Supreme Court this week, the Arizona SB 1070 decision. This was the law that essentially allowed or told law enforcement officers in Arizona that they were now going to ask everybody that they stopped or arrested or detained for their immigration status and try to get information about that. That law was only in one particular upheld by the court, and that was this central idea of show us your papers. That enforcement has not actually begun. It's been stayed by lower courts. So now the Supreme Court said 8-0, go ahead and try that enforcement. Let's see if when you actually start doing it, it passes other constitutional tests like equal protection under the law and whether or not it, you know, devolves into racial profiling and things of that nature, in which case we'll see the case again. With respect to the other 3/4 of the disputed parts of that Arizona law, the Supreme Court threw all of those out and said the state has no right to arrogate to itself the immigration law function. That's a federal function. And even if you don't like what the federal government is doing or not doing to stop illegal immigration, you as a state, Arizona, are not entitled to just make your own policy on immigration and substitute it for the federal policy you're not happy with or the absence of federal policy. John Roberts signed on to that part, slapping Arizona down in all but one particular of the law and really invalidating the essential thrust of Arizona's law by doing so. He joined the liberals on the court here again, minus Elena Kagan, who recused herself. She had been the Solicitor General when this law came up. And Anthony Kennedy also was voting on this particular side. So they had a 5-3 majority here with a decision that, while, you know, it could be defended from the standpoint of Arizona, it was basically a disappointment to conservatives. Two times in this week that John Roberts had joined with the other side, if you will, of the court's partisan divide.
Before I speak to the substance of immigration, may I just cite my favorite tweet of the week after the Arizona ruling and then after the healthcare ruling today? Sam Youngman, he's a White House reporter for Bloomberg, tweets, John Roberts is so going to get primaried.
And indeed, if he were a Republican senator from Indiana or Utah or someplace like that, I think we could assume that the Tea Party would have a candidate up against him very soon.
Now, I keep talking about Romney because I've spent the last couple of weeks inside the Romney campaign bubble, and it is very interesting, the different approach from Romney on the healthcare ruling and what we saw on the immigration ruling. Today with the healthcare ruling, he was out there with the Capitol as the backdrop with just 75 minutes after the ruling came down, making his statement. With the Arizona immigration law, we just happened to be in Arizona that day, in Scottsdale for a fundraiser. What a perfect place to make a public statement.
How convenient.
About the law that you once very vocally supported. So after flying all the way to Arizona and spending 6 hours on the ground there, we're waiting for a public statement, we're waiting for a public statement, we're waiting for a public statement. He finally said something to a fundraiser where there were no cameras present, essentially saying, he wished that the courts had given states a little more leeway here. But he did not praise the law. He did not condemn the ruling. So that one was clearly very difficult politically for them, because on one hand, they're trying to appeal to their base and their Tea Party base.
And immigration matters a great deal to that base.
And we also know he's been reaching out to Latino voters, trying to cut into that huge margin that polls say President Obama has with Latinos and Hispanics.
And widening, actually, widening in the weeks since the president came out in favor of sort of a backdoor version of the DREAM Act, cutting off the deportation of youths brought here by their parents illegally. So that was a bit of a tough day for the Romney campaign and trying to figure out how to talk about that. Maybe the other subject they talk about less, even than that particular immigration issue, is Romney's own health care plan back in Massachusetts, and that's going to be thrust into the fore again because of this now Supreme Court decision. And there was one other Supreme Court decision this week that matters a great deal to politics. The court struck down a Montana law that had been upheld by the Montana Supreme Court, which was a century old and which had a restrictive effect on independent expenditures by labor unions and corporations. This was out of sync with the court's own Citizens United ruling back in 2010.
Which has brought so much money into the system, into the election this year.
And connected with other rulings that the courts have made, not necessarily the Supreme Court, but other federal courts and the FEC, has really opened the floodgates. We'll probably have the two presidential candidates each spending over $1 billion this year, and another $1 billion being spent on congressional races, largely because of these changes in the interpretation of the law. And when they were given the opportunity to revisit their Citizens United decision of 2010, the court said, nope, we're good with that. Anthony Kennedy wrote the opinion saying Montana can't have that law because it is at odds with our Citizens United ruling. So out it goes.
There is some consistency between these three rulings, health care, immigration, the Montana campaign money law. In each case, kind of the federal authority is asserted. The Supreme Court authority is asserted.
Yes. That's right. The federal government in the guise of the Supreme Court in this particular instance. All right, we've got a few other things going on in Washington besides the Supreme Court, although they certainly had a memorable final week in this session. Also going on the legal front, we have the unprecedented vote in the House to hold in contempt of Congress Attorney General Eric Holder, who has not been forthcoming about certain documents that the Congress has demanded, specifically a House committee chaired by Daryl Issa. This all has to do with the botched Fast and Furious program that was an attempt by the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Agency to get some evidence on gun runners across the Mexican border.
Allow the guns into the country and trace them.
One of them, of course, was traced to a crime scene in the murder of a Border Patrol agent, tragedy of a few years ago. And in their attempt to investigate this, congressional investigators have felt they have not had the full cooperation of the Department of Justice. They've tried to negotiate. They've had hearings. And now they want to hold the Attorney General in contempt of Congress. And in that vote being held on Thursday night, there is absolutely no question but that the Republicans in the House will vote to hold him in contempt, and a couple of dozen Democrats will probably join in large measure because the National Rifle Association has scored this vote, and they, of course, will ding you as a member of Congress if you don't vote with them on every issue, and many of the Democrats in the House do.
And it happening in a campaign year, it is an opportunity that Republicans see to discredit the White House kind of from something other than Obamacare. And in the aggregate, they see these things starting to pile up, and they hope that the general public will start to get kind of even more of an uneasy feeling about everything's not quite so right in the White House. I have not encountered voters out there who raise Fast and Furious, but I do hear them say at every event, it's like their talking points, they talk about the cronyism of the Obama White House. And they do see Eric Holder as being part of that. And it's that narrative that I do think started with the Tea Party, but has spread pretty broadly, at least among people who consider themselves, you know, very strong critics of the administration who are showing up at Mitt Romney events or earlier any candidate's events.
Right. And the way in which that has focused on Eric Holder, of course, raises certain questions and issues as well, which is why the Congressional Black Caucus took the vote to walk off the floor of the House in protest of the vote holding Holder in contempt. What this all boils down to in the end is far from clear. No one really expects there to be a criminal charge lodged against the Attorney General, but whether it, of course, removes him from office. No one expects that to happen because, among other things, he's not expected to serve past a first term in any event. So it's another one of those moments of Washington gesture that has a great deal of meaning for advocates on both sides, activists on both sides, possibly will not affect the life of very many other people. Can't let the week go by without noting that New York State had its primaries last week, and the Democratic power structure in New York City and statewide certainly had a good week in the contested primaries there. Charlie Rangel, not everybody's favorite guy anymore, going on 44 years in the House, has had his ethics problems, lost his ways and means chairmanship, and so on.
If we thought he'd used up his nine lives, he's got a tenth, apparently.
Apparently, at least a tenth. He was able to hold off a very attractive state senator who was running against him, Charlie Rangel, nominated for a 22nd term. In addition to Charlie Rangel, two other candidates favored by the New York Democratic Party establishment, Grace Meng in the Gary Ackerman district, where he's retiring, and also Hakeem Jeffries in the Ed Towns district, where he's retiring, both won over more insurgent candidates. So Grace Meng would be, if she is elected in November, as is expected, the first Asian-American representative from New York.
And Utah held its primary as well. And the survivor there, someone who has learned key lessons about survival even over the past few years with the rise of the Tea Party, is Senator Orrin Hatch. And you're going to have to tell me how many terms he has served.
He has just won the nomination for his seventh. He is in his sixth six-year term.
So Hatch was one of those Republicans that the Tea Party looked at and said, he is not sufficiently conservative for us. He's great friends with Ted Kennedy.
He was, indeed he was.
But Hatch watched and learned. We had Utah's last contested Senate
Robert Bennett,
actually lose at the state party convention.
Didn't even get to the primary.
Didn't get to the primary 2 years ago because of the Tea Party. And Mike Lee, the senator from Utah, now sits in that chair, a favorite of the Tea Party. So here's what Orrin Hatch has done. This is, I believe, early last year. There was a Tea Party tele-town hall here in Washington, D.C., and some Tea Party favorites were there. Those on the stage were all invited by the Tea Party. Senator Lee was there. Rand Paul was there. Michelle Bachmann, then getting ready to run for president, was there. And lo and behold, an uninvited guest showed up. And because he happened to be a six-term United States senator, they found a chair for him. It was Orrin Hatch coming to make his presence felt and to make the Tea Party know he's their friend and he's ready to work with them.
Yes, he got the signal. He raised his American Conservative Union rating from 89 lifetime to 100 in the last 2 years and showed that he could be just as perfect as anyone could ask for, and took essentially the same approach that John McCain took to saving his seat in Arizona in the 2010 senatorial election. He had a primary from a Tea Party candidate, and he won largely by showing everybody he could be as conservative as they could want. And Dick Lugar, another guy who is finishing his sixth term in the Senate this year, in Indiana, got a tough Tea Party challenge in his state this year and said, hey, I'm who I am. I'm going to do what I've always done. People know me. I am Indiana. And he got skunked in his primary in a way that no one could have imagined even a year, certainly 2 years ago, by Richard Murdoch, who is now the Republican nominee in Indiana. And this was the lesson that Orrin Hatch, I think, learned faster than anybody else. He was back there even a couple years ago learning the Bennett lesson immediately. Hmm. And this week, it came through for him. He won easily against his challenge from former state senator Dan Lilienquist.
2-1.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Don Gagne.
And join us again next week when Ken Rudin will be back for It's All Politics from NPR. I'm all for love.